Ladies and gentlemen, in this evening's lecture I propose to consider the relationship between objectivism and theism. Dr. Nathaniel Brandon, in his lecture, The Existence of God, which we are considering tonight, argues that atheism is an essential part of the objectivist position. I grant that it is a part of the position taken by Miss Rand and by Dr. Brandon, but I deny that it follows logically from the basic objectivist principles about the nature of reality and of man's mind. I maintain, on the contrary, that these principles logically imply the existence of God, and that Miss Rand's atheism, and the same for Dr. Brandon's, is an anomaly, a logical flaw in the overall pattern of her thought. I remark parenthetically that I am aware that Dr. Brandon is no longer an authorized spokesman for Miss Rand. However, I have heard no complaint that his public statements have misrepresented her philosophy, and in any case, practically all the statements of his that we shall consider were first made, usually in the same words, while he was still her spokesman. I therefore propose to quote the two almost interchangeably. If I thereby attribute to Miss Rand beliefs that she does not hold, I shall be obliged to anyone who will correct me with supporting evidence. I shall begin by stating the positive case for theism as derived from objectivist principles, and then proceed to an examination of Dr. Brandon's arguments for atheism, explaining where I believe that they break down and why. I do not intend to present arguments for the truth of the objectivist principles, or to consider the question, how do you go about presenting the case for theism to a non-objectivist? These are worthwhile considerations, but they fall outside the scope of this evening's discussion. Three basic principles of objectivism are the following. First, that man is a rational being with a mind, a reason, an intellect, a consciousness. Second, that there exists an objective reality, a world external to and independent of man's consciousness. Third, that man's mind, man's reason, is an adequate and appropriate instrument for the investigation of reality. It is not, of course, claimed that man is either infallible or omniscient, but only that his use of his reason to explore the universe is right in principle, is appropriate to reality. Now this claim, which is certainly at the very core of objectivist philosophy, has some far-reaching consequences. You cannot believe in the mind as an adequate instrument unless you hold certain ideas about how that instrument functions. Thus, for example, in the May 1963 Objectivist newsletter, and again almost verbatim in his book, The Psychology of Self-Esteem, Dr. Brandon maintains that the objectivist view of man presupposes free will. Since Dr. Brandon's argument for free will is going to be of central importance in tonight's discussion, I quote it at considerable length. The following is from The Psychology of Self-Esteem, beginning on paperback page 53. Quote, free will, in the widest meaning of the term, is the doctrine that man is capable of performing actions which are not determined by forces outside his control, that man is capable of making choices which are not necessitated by antecedent factors. As one writer formulates it, quote from Richard Taylor, in the case of an action that is free, it must be such that it is caused by the agent who performs it, but such that no antecedent conditions were necessary for performing just that action. Close quote by Brandon from Taylor, quote from Brandon continues. The concept of man as a being of volitional consciousness stands in sharp contrast to the view that dominates our culture in general and the social sciences in particular, the doctrine of psychological determinism. Psychological determinism denies the existence of any element of freedom or volition in man's consciousness. It holds that, in any given situation or moment, only one choice is psychologically possible to man, the inevitable result of all the antecedent determining forces impinging on him, just as only one action is possible to the speck of dust. That man has no actual power of choice, no actual freedom or self-responsibility. Man, according to this view, has no more actual volition than a stone. He is merely confronted with more complex alternatives and is manipulated by more complex forces. The doctrine of determinism contains a central and insuperable contradiction, an epistemological contradiction, a contradiction implicit in any variety of determinism, whether the alleged determining forces be physical, psychological, environmental, or divine. The determinist view of mind maintains that whether a man thinks or not, whether he takes cognizance of the facts of reality or not, whether he places facts above feelings or feelings above facts, all are determined by forces outside his control. In any given moment or situation, his method of mental functioning is the inevitable product of an endless chain of antecedent functions. He has no choice in the matter. That which a man does, declare the advocates of determinism, he had to do. That which he believes, he had to believe. If he focuses his mind, he had to. If he evades the effort of focusing, he had to. If he is guided solely by reason, he had to be. If he is ruled instead by feeling or whim, he had to be. He couldn't help it. But if this were true, no knowledge, no conceptual knowledge, would be possible to man. No theory could claim greater plausibility than any other, including the theory of psychological determinism. Man is neither omniscient nor infallible. This means, A, that he must work to achieve his knowledge, and B, that the mere presence of an idea inside his mind does not prove that the idea is true. Many ideas may enter a man's mind which are false. But if man believes what he has to believe, if he is not free to test his beliefs against reality and to validate them or reject them, if the actions and content of his mind are determined by factors that may or may not have anything to do with reason, logic, and reality, then he can never know if his conclusions are true or false. If his capacity to judge is not free, there is no way for a man to distinguish between his beliefs and those of a raving lunatic. But then how did the advocates of determinism acquire their knowledge? What is its validation? Determinists are conspicuously silent on this point. They cannot claim to know that their theory is true. They can only report that they feel helpless to believe otherwise. Nor can they claim that their theory is highly probable. They can only acknowledge the inner compulsion that forbids them to doubt that it is highly probable. Some advocates of determinism, evidently sensing this epistemological dilemma, have sought to escape it by asserting that, although they are determined to believe what they believe, the factor determining them is logic. But by what means do they know this? Their beliefs are no more subject to their control than those of a lunatic. They and the lunatic are equally the pawn of deterministic forces. Both are incapable of judging their judgments. One of the defining characteristics of psychosis is loss of volitional control over rational judgments. But according to determinism, that is man's normal metaphysical state. There is no escape from determinism's epistemological dilemma. The very concept of logic is possible only to a volitional consciousness. An automatic consciousness could have no need of it and could not conceive of it. Only because man is a being of volitional consciousness, only because he is free to initiate and sustain a reasoning process, is conceptual knowledge, in contradistinction to irresistible unchosen beliefs, possible to him. Close quote from Dr. Brandon. Now, let us consider the application of this principle, not simply to an individual thought here and there, but to a man's reason considered as a whole. A man has an intellect, a reason, a mind. How did that mind come about? Short of reincarnation, a theory I believe Dr. Brandon does not hold, it will scarcely be maintained that a given individual mind has existed forever. But, as Dr. Brandon remarked in this evening's lecture, quote, "All emergences of new entities presuppose the existence of entities that caused their emergence." Close quote. Now, whatever is caused was brought about by design or by accident. Throughout this lecture, I shall mean by design the occurrence of something as the result of someone's intending it, and by accident, the occurrence of something not as the result of anyone's intending it. Is man's mind the product of accident or design? To understand this question is to see that the answer must be design if man's mind is to be a suitable instrument for its purpose, the understanding of objective reality. If a mind were brought about simply by the actions of non-conscious entities, then any resemblance between the ideas it formed and the truth would be sheer coincidence. It may be helpful at this point to introduce an illustrative example. Suppose that a man is lost in the desert and comes across a pointed stick with a couple of wavy parallel lines scratched on it. He asks himself, "How did this stick come to be here?" and makes a guess at the answer. Perhaps he decides that the wavy lines were drawn by someone as a symbol for water, and the stick placed there to point the direction to the nearest oasis. If he holds this belief, then it makes sense for him to accept the stick as evidence of the direction of the nearest oasis. On the other hand, perhaps he decides that the stick came there by accident, that it fell from the load of a prospector's donkey, or was dropped by a nest-building eagle, or whatever, and that the scratches are the gnawings of animals. Now, this is a perfectly reasonable assumption. What is not reasonable is for him to say, "I propose to assume that this stick came here by accident, but I also propose to accept the scratches on it and the direction it points as evidence of the direction of the nearest oasis." Similarly, a man may believe that his thinking apparatus came about by design or that it came about by accident, but he may not believe that it came about by accident and simultaneously believe that it provides him with any evidence at all about the nature of reality. Just as anyone who accepts the stick as evidence of the location of the oasis has, whether he realizes it or not, logically committed himself to believing that the stick was placed there by design, i.e., placed by a rational agent for the purpose of providing evidence about the location of the oasis, just so anyone who accepts the objectivist view of man's mind has committed himself, whether he realizes it or not, to believing that man's mind was designed by a rational agent for the purpose of understanding, of apprehending objective reality. I claim that this rational agent may reasonably be called God, a claim that I shall defend later. Let us now consider several objections that are likely to be raised against this argument. Some people say, "But why assume more than you need? Why assume that your brain was designed and from this deduce the reliability of your thoughts? Why not simply assume the reliability of your thoughts as an initial premise and go on from there?" To this we may reply, "But we do start out by believing in the validity of human reason. There is no possibility of starting out anywhere else. You cannot deduce the validity of reason from other premises unless you have already assumed its validity beforehand. The validity of reason is the necessary first assumption of all argument, or rather, is the only context in which talk about arguments, deductions, and assumptions has any meaning. We do not postulate a designer and deduce the validity of reason. We rather ask, in the context of belief in that validity, which is the only context for asking anything, what beliefs about the origin of man's mind are compatible with that context?" To this our man may say, "That is quite reasonable, of course, but it doesn't really answer my question. It merely shows that I phrased the question ambiguously. Is the principle that the human mind is an adequate instrument really incompatible with the view that the instrument came about by accident? Consider your stick-in-the-desert illustration. A stick that had fallen by accident could, nevertheless, point to the oasis. Instead of assuming that the stick was left there to point to the oasis and then following it, why not assume that it accidentally points to the oasis, and then follow it?" Here we see a confusion between two similar but distinct propositions. One, that the stick points to the oasis, and two, that the stick is evidence for the location of the oasis. The first of these is compatible with either accident or design. The second is compatible only with design. If you assume that the stick is there by accident, you may say, "I have no evidence as to which way the oasis lies, but I don't intend to lie down and die. I will pick a direction at random and start walking. I will, in fact, pick the direction this stick is pointing, which is as good as any other direction." And this is reasonable. What you cannot do is claim that the stick is evidence. If you have a companion who says, "Instead of taking the direction of the stick, let us take another direction 28 degrees to the left of that indicated by the stick," you cannot give any reason for preferring your arbitrarily selected guess to his. If you follow his suggestion and come to the oasis, it is a marvelously lucky coincidence, but so is it if you follow the line of the stick directly and come to the oasis. But what we believe about our reason is not that it makes lucky guesses about the nature of reality, but that it provides evidence of the nature of reality, that it is a fit instrument for exploring reality. If the lucky guess hypothesis were tenable, it would be tenable in the context of determinism also. We could assume that the causal chains that determine our thoughts just happen to cause us to think true thoughts. But if this is not an acceptable alternative to the theory of free will, still less is it an acceptable alternative to the theory that our minds have a designer. Another objection that may be raised is as follows. You have been speaking as if our minds were isolated from the physical universe, as if there were no causal relationship between our minds and reality. If that were so, then one would certainly be hard put to explain how our minds can learn anything about reality without some kind of help, divine help if you like. But in fact, our minds, or at any rate our brains, are clearly part of the interlocking causal network of the world. It is therefore no coincidence if they reflect it, and reflect it accurately at that. You spoke of a stick falling to the ground near an oasis. Now, an oasis has no particular causal effect on sticks dropped a mile or so away. But suppose that it were a question of an iron mine, and a lodestone dropped by accident. Would it not make sense to accept the lodestone as evidence of the location of the mine? But, just as the mine has a causal effect on the lodestone, so the universe has an effect on us. This sounds promising, but only, I fear, for the moment. It is, of course, perfectly true that the world about us influences us and our thoughts. The question is whether it has any built-in tendency to influence them toward true thoughts. If it does, then Dr. Brandon's objection to psychological determinism collapses. And that is not all. Any feeling we may have, for any reason whatever, has the same evidential status as the most careful observation in the most rigorous chain of reasoning. If you have a feeling that a certain long shot is going to win at the races, put your shirt on it. You would not have that feeling if it had not been caused by something which, in its turn, has some chain of causality connecting it with the horse. Ladies and gentlemen, anyone who upon reflection finds this alternative to theism attractive has disagreements with me, and for that matter with Dr. Brandon, which go far beyond the scope of this lecture. Perhaps the most complex objection we must consider is the Darwinian objection. Someone may say, there is really no difference between this argument and the old design argument. Writers like Paley used to invite us to consider the eye of the mosquito and ask ourselves whether this marvelously intricate mechanism could have come about by accident. If not, then here we had design, and so a designer. But then Darwin showed us that natural selection, although it had no conscious goals, acted in a sense as if it did. Mosquitoes have eyes that see efficiently because the ones that didn't have died out. Similarly, men have brains that work efficiently because the ones that didn't have died out. I shall refer to the attempt to account for man's reason in terms of natural selection as psychological Darwinism. What the psychological Darwinist overlooks is that natural selection is concerned only with the physical actions of an organism, and that we are concerned in this argument with thoughts which are not the same thing. Suppose that some foxes are chasing some rabbits. The rabbits that run slower get caught and eaten, while the faster-than-average rabbits live and have little rabbits, which are presumably also faster than average. And so a fast-running strain of rabbits is developed. But note that whether a rabbit gets caught depends only on his physical actions, on how fast he moves, how suddenly he dodges, and the like. Whether he gets caught is not at all dependent on whether he feels fear, or whether he realizes what will happen to him if he's caught, or anything of that sort. An intelligent rabbit, a robot rabbit, so long as they make the same moves, have the same chance of escaping. One reason why many people find evolution by natural selection an adequate account of the origins of man's consciousness is that they have consciously accepted, or more often been influenced by, the behavioristic approach. For the behaviorist, thinking simply consists of a certain kind of physical behavior. Awareness of danger is deemed to be identical with avoidance behavior, so that if two monkeys both leap for a tree when a tiger approaches, the suggestion that they may not be thinking about the tiger is meaningless. Thinking the tiger dangerous means, to the extent that it means anything, jumping out of the way. Fear and pain mean exhibiting avoidance reactions. Intelligence means exhibiting intelligent behavior, which in its turn may mean anything from stalking game skillfully to checking the right boxes on an IQ test. Now, when I say that one of the fundamental principles of objectivism is that man has a consciousness, a reason, a mind, I assume that it is understood that these words are not being used in a behaviorist sense. Dr. Brandon is quite emphatic about what he means by consciousness. Quote from Self-Esteem, pages 7 through 12. That mental processes are correlated with neural processes in the brain in no way affects the status of consciousness as a unique and irreducible primary. It is a species of what philosophers term the reductive fallacy to assert that mental processes are nothing but neural processes, that, for example, the perception of an object is a collection of neural impulses, or that a thought is a certain pattern of brain activity. A perception and the neural processes that mediate it are not identical, nor are a thought and the brain activity that may accompany it. Such an equation is flagrantly anti-empirical and logically absurd. Radical behaviorism is explicit reductive materialism. It holds that mind is a series of bodily responses, such as muscular and glandular reactions. Methodological behaviorists may wish to deny that they are reductive materialists, but then, as a minimum, their doctrine entails a belief in another, no more promising version of materialism, epiphenomenalism, the doctrine that consciousness is merely an incidental byproduct of physical processes, as smoke is a byproduct of a locomotive, and that conscious events have no causal efficacy, neither with regard to bodily events nor to other mental events, i.e., one's thoughts do not have the power to affect either one's actions or one's subsequent thoughts. The behaviorist has been conspicuously reluctant to enunciate the conclusions to which his theory leads. He has not, for instance, felt obliged to declare, "Since phenomena of consciousness are illusory or irrelevant to explanations of behavior, and since this includes my behavior, nothing that I may think, understand, or perceive, whatever these terms mean, bears any causal relation to the things I do or the theories I advocate." When a person puts forth a doctrine which amounts to the assertion either that he is not conscious, or that it makes no difference to him and should make no difference to others whether he is conscious or not, the irresistible temptation is to agree with him. Close quote. At least in objectivist circles, one would not expect to find many avowed behaviorists. But when a certain assumption, largely unspoken, pervades much of contemporary writing, many people who do not explicitly accept it may be influenced by it. I believe that the influence of behaviorism is chiefly responsible for the willingness of many people to accept a psychological Darwinian account of the origins of the mind. If we distinguish clearly between thoughts and physical actions, we see at once that there is no reason why natural selection should be expected to produce thoughts at all, let alone true thoughts. We may put it this way. Let us suppose that among our remote ancestors there were two kinds of monkeys. Some were conscious and aware of what went on around them, while others had no consciousness at all, were simply complicated physical objects. Again, in each group, some had behavior patterns based either on reason or on reflexes, which caused them to jump for a tree when a tiger came near. Thus we have aware and jumping monkeys, aware and non-jumping monkeys, non-aware and jumping monkeys, and non-aware and non-jumping monkeys. Natural selection discriminates between the jumpers and the non-jumpers, eliminating the latter, but makes no distinction at all between the aware and the non-aware. We have the four types arranged, so to speak, in two rows and two columns, but we are interested for our present purposes in the difference between the rows, while natural selection is relevant only to the difference between the columns, and hence irrelevant to our present concern. But, it may be argued, surely it is more useful to have true beliefs about the world than false ones or no beliefs at all. To this I reply, not always. I can walk the length of a narrow plank on the ground much more easily than I can an equally narrow one several feet off the ground. If I had to walk a plank over a canyon, my chances of success would be considerably increased by an optical illusion that made the floor of the canyon seem to be only a few inches below the plank. And there are many like me. There is no logical necessity for useful action to be based on true beliefs. If you set out to design a monkey that will jump out of the way of a tiger, there are at least four ways you can do it. 1. Mind controlling and informed. 2. Mind controlling but deceived. 3. Mind non-controlling. And 4. Mind non-existent. First, mind controlling and informed. You can give the monkey a mind and a will and a system of values that includes a value for its own survival and the consequent unwillingness to tangle with a tiger, and a mind-body relationship such that sense data are transmitted accurately from his body to his mind, and decisions about action are transmitted accurately from his mind to his body. Presumably, we ourselves are examples of this sort of arrangement. Second, mind controlling but deceived. You can give the monkey a mind and have it directing the activities of the body, but deceived about what it is doing. Here's an example. During the Second World War, the psychologist B.F. Skinner developed a missile guidance system that used pigeons. The birds were given, say, an aerial photograph of downtown Berlin and trained to peck at the Brandenburg Gate, being rewarded with grain when they did so. Then they were put into a missile aimed in the general direction of Berlin. A camera in the nose of the missile threw a picture on the screen. When Berlin appeared on the screen, the pigeons pecked at the picture of the Brandenburg Gate. If the missile was headed straight for the gate, the pigeons pecked the center of the screen, and the missile maintained course. If the missile was off course, the pigeons pecked to one side, and various devices transmitted this imbalance to the steering mechanism of the missile, which corrected the course. Result? Bullseye. I am told that the device worked fairly well in practice runs, but that the war ended before Eisenhower got around to turning Skinner loose on the Brandenburg Gate. If we suppose that the pigeons were probably in some rudimentary sense thinking, but not thinking about hitting the Brandenburg Gate, just about getting their dinner, then we have an example of method 2. Third, mind non-controlling. You can give the monkey a mind, but with no connection at all between mind and body, so that the mind is hallucinating about something while the body carries on its own. We are examples of this too in some instances. When you step barefooted on a hot surface, first your nervous system generates a muscular reaction that jerks your foot back, and then you feel pain, and then you realize what has happened and form the intellectual judgment that moving your foot was a good idea. But if your physical response had been dependent on your making a rational judgment that avoiding the hot surface was an action conducive to survival, and not merely to survival as an organism, but to survival in the manner appropriate to man's nature as a rational being, your foot would have been pretty badly burned. In this instance, at least, we see that the approach whereby the body survives because it is physically programmed with the right stimulus response patterns to survive, and the mind does not enter the situation at all until later, is actually more efficient than the use of the mind as a tool of survival. Fourth, mind non-existent. You can give the monkey no mind at all and have him avoid tigers because his nervous system is programmed to do so. An example of this would be the activities of, say, insects, who carry on some very elaborate activities, apparently simply because they are wired to do so. Computers and electronic guidance systems are perhaps even better examples. Now, if you are simply interested in getting certain physical behavior from the organism, any one of these four ways will do. And the survival of an organism depends on its physical behavior, not on its thoughts, except insofar as these affect the physical behavior. The theory that man's reason, man's consciousness, developed as the result of natural selection, takes it as self-evident that the ability to reason is conducive to man's survival as a species. But is it? Undoubtedly, the Industrial Revolution, the growth of modern science, the whole Western intellectual tradition from Aristotle down, has been a great blessing to mankind. But it is another question whether it has been precisely the sort of blessing that psychological Darwinism requires. Where natural selection is concerned, it does not in the least matter whether the individual members of a species are happy, or wise, or just, or well-fed, or even long-lived. The only question is whether the species survives. And the human species, precisely because its members have minds, has a significant chance of not surviving for another century. I am not joining the ranks of those who wish to repeal the Industrial Revolution when I point out that we may blow ourselves up with atomic weapons or poison ourselves with some exotic new chemical or prosaic old one. On the other hand, there is no species of monkey or ape that I know of that is in serious danger, or would be in serious danger if it were not for man, of becoming extinct in the next 100 years. If you are concerned, as I assume we all are, with the quality of human life, then having the sort of minds that can invent nuclear weapons is worth the risk of being blown up with nuclear weapons. But if nature, being indifferent to the quality of life and concerned only with quantity, developed rational faculties in some primate 2 million years ago in order to increase the chances that organisms descended from that primate might still be around 2.1 million years later, then it must be concluded that nature erred. Someone may say, but the dangers to the species that you refer to are not dangers that come from man's rationality. They come from his irrationality. We need more rationality, not less. If people would only listen to Ayn Rand, would institute laissez-faire societies everywhere where the concept of property rights that kept one man from polluting another man's stream without permission, there would be no danger from fallout, or pollution, or anything else. This objection confuses two different uses of the word rational. We may say that man is a rational animal, meaning that, unlike the beasts, he possesses a mind. Or we may say that a certain man is being rational, meaning that he is using his mind, that he is choosing to think, that he is, as Dr. Brandon would say, focusing on his problems instead of blanking out. Now, given that a man has a mind, if anyone wishes to maintain that he promotes his own chances of survival, and also the collective chances of the species, by habitually choosing to think clearly, I have no objection. But notice that this is a question of free will, of his choosing to think. You cannot, by natural selection or any other way, breed a race of men whose genes determine that they will always, or usually, freely choose to think clearly. You cannot determine anyone to do anything freely. As for the other sense of rationality, the simple possession of the faculty of consciousness, apart from how the user chooses to use it, there is no ready refutation of the evolutionary biologist who says simply, consciousness is a lethal mutation. Someone may object, but atomic bombs and the like are a very recent danger. Man's mind evolved over millions of years. During most of those years, it was an advantage to him, in the crude sense of being conducive to the survival of the species. If it has lately become a disadvantage to him, that is irrelevant to the overall picture. Let us meet that argument on its own ground. Atheism is a philosophical theory, and those who propound it suppose that men are equipped to philosophize. Psychological Darwinism tells us that we can trust a man's reasoning on questions of philosophy because his brain is the product of years of evolution by natural selection, during which nature shaped that brain into a tool suitable for producing survival-conducive behavior in a primitive environment. The tacit premise is that a tool suitable for producing such behavior is a tool suitable for producing sound philosophical theories, and that the more suitable a given brain is for the one purpose, the more suitable for the other. Now, if this be so, then no one should be given a degree in philosophy without passing a wilderness survival test. disputes between rival philosophical positions should be settled by taking a representative of each, physically matched as far as possible, dropping them without tools or supplies in the middle of the Australian outback, and seeing who reaches Sydney first. And, of course, the reproductive aspect must not be ignored. To a population geneticist, an individual that lives in excellent health to a ripe old age and dies without leaving offspring might as well have died in infancy. Either way, he is a complete genetic failure, and, according to psychological Darwinism, a complete epistemological failure as well. To an objectivist who is also a psychological Darwinist, I say, evaluate the following statements. The best measure we have of any philosopher's competence, including Miss Rand, is the size of that philosopher's family. If you mark that statement true, you have repudiated objectivism. If you mark it false, you have repudiated psychological Darwinism. You can't have both. I suspect that no matter how many disclaimers I offer, nothing will prevent some of my listeners from seizing on these remarks and saying, "Aha! The theist is showing his true colors by disparaging reason." One more disclaimer. I am not disparaging reason. I am saying that its function is not to enable men to survive as organisms, but to survive in the manner appropriate to men. But survival as organisms is all that is relevant to natural selection. Anyone who accepts psychological Darwinism is saying, in effect, the only important, the only significant characteristic of true thoughts as opposed to false ones is that they lead to actions that are conducive to survival. A monkey that gets out of the way of a tiger, a monkey that survives, has passed the only intelligence test that matters. As for the suggestion that his thoughts may be erroneous, even though his actions are useful, such worries are either meaningless or irrelevant. In the words of Dr. Brandon, already quoted, when a person puts forth a doctrine which amounts to the assertion either that he is not conscious, or that it makes no difference to him and should make no difference to others, whether he is conscious or not, the irresistible temptation is to agree with him. Close quote. And this is where all forms of psychological Darwinism, at least in an objectivist context, get into trouble. If any professed objectivist undertakes to explain the origin of man's mind by natural selection, the first question I have for him is, do you accept as sound Dr. Brandon's analysis of the epistemological self-contradictions of determinism? If you do, please reread his analysis and explain to me how your psychological Darwinism escapes being vulnerable to a parallel analysis. If you do not accept Dr. Brandon's analysis, then you are in the wrong meeting. I have undertaken to show that the fundamental principles of objectivism logically imply the existence of God. Defending those fundamental principles is not in my contract for this evening. To my objectivist and semi-objectivist listeners, I say, the more carefully and thoroughly you consider psychological Darwinism, the more obvious will become its utter, complete, and fundamental incompatibility with objectivism. Again and again in Atlas Shrugged and elsewhere, Miss Rand emphasizes the fact that you cannot get positive results by pointing a gun at a man's head and ordering him to think. But the psychological Darwinists tell us that you can get positive results. They believe that nature has done just this, and that all reasoning, all thought whatever, is the result of nature's having pointed a gun, or a tiger, at our remote ancestors and ordered them to think. Further comment seems needless. Now I come to two objections to the epistemological proof, or as I prefer to call it, the objectivist proof of the existence of God, which I suspect have been in the minds of many of you since I began to present it. The first is, if God made my mind, then who made God's mind? Did his mind come about by accident or design? If by accident, then his thoughts are not evidence of the nature of reality, and by derivation, neither are mine. If by design, then you have merely put the problem back one more stage. Are you going to ask us to believe in an infinite series of gods, each created by the previous one? In fact, this is not the line I intend to take. I cannot see that an infinite chain of gods provides us with any help. Suppose I tell you that there is intelligent life on Mars, and you ask me how I know, and I answer, I heard it from my professor. You then ask me how my professor knows, and I say, he heard it from his professor. Further questions establish that I am supposing this information to have been passed down from professor to student an infinite number of times. Now, quite apart from your doubts that professors have been around quite that long, I think you would find this an insufficient reason for accepting the statement about Mars. You would say that a false statement can travel down an infinite chain just as readily as a true one, and that if each professor is simply passing on, uncritically, what was told to him, then we have no grounds for supposing the statement to be true. I agree. The same thing applies if we suppose that there is one professor who has lived an infinite time and has always known that there is life on Mars. Only a habitual respect for the wisdom of age hinders us from seeing at once that an infinitely old professor could have been wrong all his life just as easily as right all his life. It would thus seem that we have reached a dead end. An infinite series does not help, and a finite series leaves us with a problem about the origin of the mind of the top god which is just as pressing as the problem about the origins of our own minds. Was the first mind created by accident or design? However, there is one context in which the problem does not arise. One thing about which I am never mistaken, about which it is impossible for me to be mistaken, is my sense data at this moment. If someone tells me that there is not really a bug biting the back of my neck, it just feels as if there is, I grant that he may be right. But if he tells me that I am not really experiencing discomfort, it just feels as if I am, then I know that he is wrong. If pain is an illusion, it is a painful illusion. The man who says, I see an elephant in the shrubbery, is probably wrong. A man who says, I see red spots in front of my eyes, may possibly be lying, but he is not mistaken. If he thinks he sees red spots, then he is seeing red spots, period. To say, Jones feels a tickling sensation, and to say, Jones seems to himself to feel a tickling sensation, is to say the same thing twice in different words. Now I maintain that the only hypothesis about the origin of our minds that is consistent with objectivist principles is that they were designed, either directly or at several removes, by an ultimate designer whose mind is related to the whole of reality, as our minds are to our own sense data. Thus, his judgments about reality are always correct, and there is no need to account for that correctness any more than there is any need to account for the fact that the number 6 is such an amazingly close approximation to the number 6. It is not just that he is always right. That would be ordinary run-of-the-mill omniscience. What is at stake here is logical or necessary omniscience. To say, such and such is true, and the ultimate designer believes that such and such is true, is to say the same thing twice in different words. When I started to plan this speech, I made an outline of what in general I wanted to say, and then by expanding some parts of the outline into a verbatim transcript, made an estimate of how long the speech would be. The first estimate was 18 hours. You will be glad to know that I've made some cuts. One of the things that went was practically everything about ethics. About all I have to say at this point is that when we talk about man's reason as a suitable instrument for perceiving the nature of reality, this includes perceiving the moral nature of reality. Just as we have seen that God is necessarily omniscient so that the statements P is true and God believes that P is true are really the same thing said in different words, so the statements X is good and God believes that X is good are synonyms. We express this by saying that God is normative, meaning that he is the standard of value.